morning, everyone. Energy and climate will come to order. We have minutes. Representative Long, would you move the minutes?
I would. I move that the minutes from January 24th, be approved.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are approved. This morning we're going to concentrate on efficiency, and I would welcome our new Commissioner of Commerce, who is going to start us off. We're so glad to have you here, and so glad you're the new Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the invitation to be here this morning. I'm Steve Kelly. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and with me is the Director of our State Energy Office, Jessica Burdett. I've had an opportunity to read part of the energy efficiency report, but I have not been through it. So I'm going to, at certain points, especially in response to questions that members have, rely on Ms. Burdett for the detailed answers. So let me start with background on the Minnesota Conservation Improvement Program, which is familiarly called CIP. Minnesota has over 170 electric utilities, including co-ops, municipals, and investor-owned utilities. The investor-owned utilities account for two-thirds of the state's electric load. We have three investor-owned natural gas utilities that serve 94% of the state's natural gas sales. About two-thirds of residential customers in Minnesota get their heat from natural gas. 17% of residential customers use electricity as their primary heating source, with most of the remainder using delivered fuels, primarily propane. Minnesota has been doing utility energy efficiency programs since the 1980s. These efforts ramped up in 2010 when Minnesota moved from a spending goal to a savings goal, which is 1.5% of average retail sales for electric utilities and a minimum of 1% for natural gas utilities. To meet those energy saving goals, Minnesota utilities operate a wide array of residential, commercial, and industrial CIP programs targeted to both retrofits as well as new construction projects. These energy efficiency programs help Minnesota households and businesses use electricity and natural gas more efficiently, conserving energy, reducing carbon dioxide pollution, and lessening the need for new utility infrastructure. Minnesota has been the leading Midwestern state for energy efficiency achievements for the last decade, and those achievements have been steadily growing, as you see here, for electricity. Minnesota electric utilities have met or exceeded the 1.5% annual energy savings goal each year since 2011. And in 2017, the electric investor-owned utilities had their best year in terms of overall energy savings, around 780 gigawatt hours or 2.3% savings. This was driven primarily by Xcel Energy, which achieved significantly higher energy savings in 2017 compared to past years. Natural gas energy efficiency achievements follow a similar upward trajectory. The Minnesota gas utilities overall have met the 1% minimum, but only exceeded the 1.5% goal in 2017. In both 2016 and 2017, Minnesota's gas efficiency achievements were the highest in the nation. In 2017, CenterPoint Energy had one of its most successful years ever in terms of energy savings, 2.6 million decatherms, or about 1.9% in savings. While Minnesota has historically done quite well with energy efficiency achievements, the state has heard concerns from stakeholders about being able to meet goals looking into the future. To address these concerns and plan for CIP's future, the Department of Commerce commissioned a study to look at the next decade of energy efficiency. The project team included Center for Energy and Environment, Optimal Energy, and Seventh Wave. They had three goals: estimate statewide electric and natural gas energy efficiency and carbon saving potential for 2020 through 2029, identify cost-effective opportunities for realizing the state's energy efficiency potential, and engage stakeholders to inform future energy efficiency policies and programs. Four different types of potential were estimated as part of the study. The two key types of estimated potential include the maximum achievable energy efficiency savings, which refers to what is achievable considering market barriers, but also with aggressive incentives, such as 100% rebates, and technology adoption at the theoretical maximum. Program potential refers to a subset of achievable potential with more limited incentives and program budgets. Here are the high-level results for electric utilities through the end of 2029. Compared to the baseline energy use, there is economic potential to reduce electricity usage by about one-third, and that is the green line on the chart. The program potential scenario can capture about half of this total economic potential, resulting in a 14% decrease in total electric usage compared to the baseline. And that is the blue line. And then the maximum achievable scenario can capture nearly two-thirds of the full economic potential, resulting in a projected 21% total decrease in electric usage compared to the baseline, the maroon line. This next chart shows the breakdown in end uses at the end of the study period. It shows the relative contribution to cumulative total 2029 savings for the program potential scenario. Residential represents 20% of the total, while commercial and industrial represents about 80%. You can see that for residential, lighting represents a mere 6% of total potential. Space heating shows the largest end-use potential at 35% of total residential potential. The project team did not consider fuel switching in the potential estimates, so the space heating potential is only for those homes that currently heat with electricity, which is about 17% of households in Minnesota. The reason that space heating represents such a large potential is that for those 17% of homes that heat with electricity, they use a lot of electricity, roughly double that of non-electrically heated homes, and there are some rather recent technology advances that have enabled huge savings in these electrically heated homes, which I'll talk about more shortly. In the commercial and industrial sector, lighting still represents 25% of total potential. So even though lighting has dominated savings achievements in recent years, there's still a lot of inefficient lighting out there. This end use also includes control strategies for lighting as well as fixture and lamp retrofits. We also see several new end uses increasing in importance in the commercial and industrial sector, especially refrigeration, motors, and system efficiency. System efficiency refers to energy efficiency measures that can save multiple end uses at once and often achieve increased efficiency through operating existing equipment more efficiently. For example, building automation systems in large buildings increasingly have advanced sensors and controls, which when combined with automated logic can identify, diagnose, and correct faults in large, complex heating, ventilation, and cooling systems, saving motors from running, ventilation from being pumped in, and cooling from being used when it is not needed. Within the residential sector, system efficiency includes behavioral measures like home energy reports, which also reduce energy use across multiple end uses. The project team modeled nearly 300 different gas and electric measures, but we present here the top five measures that contribute the most to residential electric potential. Two of these measures are cold climate heat pumps for electric space heating that can cut the electricity used for space heating nearly in half compared to electric resistance heating. In total, heat pumps represent over 20% of residential potential. Other measures on the list include programmable thermostats, particularly the newer smart thermostats, as well as Energy Star clothes washers and home energy reports, a proven behavioral strategy for the residential sector. We turn now to natural gas program potential. There is a total economic potential to reduce natural gas usage by about one-third by 2029. The modeling showed about one-third of this total potential being captured by the program potential scenario, or an 11% reduction in 2029 usage over the baseline, and just over half being captured by the maximum achievable scenario, or about an 18% reduction in energy usage versus the baseline projection. The next graph shows the end-use breakdown for natural gas. Residential represents a larger fraction of the total savings compared to electric. Residential savings for natural gas is nearly doubled that for electric at 40% of total savings. In general, there are less end uses for gas than there are for electric, with space heating dominating for residential, commercial, and industrial uses. Similar to electric, system efficiency is also a large opportunity in the commercial and industrial sector. For gas, within residential, natural gas measures, the top five measures represent a very significant fraction of the total savings compared to electric, increasing the relative importance of each of these measures. Condensing furnaces and boilers have long been a mainstay of residential gas programs, and our modeling shows that that will continue to be true, representing nearly 40% of total potential. As with the electric measures, programmable thermostats are also in the top five for gas. There are still a substantial number of older Minnesota homes with inadequate insulation. Thus, adequate insulation and air sealing makes this list as well. Aerosol envelope sealing is the only emerging technology measure to be on the list and is not widely used in Minnesota right now. It is an automated method of sealing up interior spaces and can dramatically decrease air infiltration compared to traditional manual air sealing methods. In our study, it's mainly applicable to new and remodeled homes, but in the future may find application with older homes as well. More information on these and other measures included in the study is available in the main report. The team also calculated the greenhouse gas emission reductions and the cumulative annual emission reductions. In 2029, the emissions reductions would be the equivalent of taking over 1 million passenger vehicles off the road, or equal to the emissions from over 500,000 single-family homes. This is from the program potential scenario. For natural gas, the avoided emissions in 2029 would be the equivalent of over 430,000 passenger vehicles, or over 270,000 single-family homes. This slide shows the total electric and natural gas budgets that were modeled for the program scenario. It represents more than a doubling of spending levels compared to current levels of spending. However, the lifetime cost of savings is still less than procuring from other sources. For electric, the spending averages around 2 cents a kilowatt hour, and for gas, it is under 30 cents per therm. Part of the study's scope was to assess current programs in Minnesota and make recommendations for programmatic strategies that will be necessary to capture the end uses and segments that we just talked about. As part of this work, the study team reviewed energy efficiency programs in Minnesota as well as around the country to distill best practices and to make recommendations. We see themes emerging from the study team's review of existing energy efficiency programs in Minnesota. First, Minnesota already has a strong foundation of effective programs. Minnesota has some of the lowest cost and best performing programs in the country, including many examples of effective, innovative programs. Second, partnerships have helped increase program effectiveness. Utilities have formed strong relationships with trade allies, such as HVAC contractors, who then help to sell the programs. The project team did hear from many smaller customer-owned utilities that they face additional challenges in implementing programs. However, where they worked together to jointly implement programs was where there was the greatest success among these customer-owned utilities. In the program's benchmarking appendix that the study team prepared as part of the work, the project team provided several examples of smaller Minnesota utilities that have joined together to run aggregated programs and some of the success that they've had with doing that. And finally, joint gas-electric programs are becoming more common and can have efficiencies in program delivery as well as increasing overall performance. From the study team's modeling, one of the main findings for electric utilities is that programs will need to expand significantly into non-lighting end uses. The bar graph on the left shows that currently lighting represents an estimated 60 to 70% of all savings for the residential sector as well as the commercial and industrial sectors. This compares to the two bar charts on the left that we've already seen for residential and commercial sectors in 2029, which show only 6% lighting savings for residential and 25% lighting savings in commercial and industrial. Therefore, programs will need to increase the effectiveness with which they are addressing other end uses besides lighting. Let's take an example of cold climate air source heat pumps, which are the largest source of savings in the residential sector for electric utilities. It's not quite the same potential as LED lighting, but it is similar in that 5 to 8 years ago, no one was predicting that LEDs would see the performance and cost improvements that they have now achieved. For the cold climate application, air source heat pumps have in the last several years seen a similar performance jump, and it has only recently become apparent how much potential this technology has in our state. Thus, this is a new source of savings that would not have shown up in this potential study if it had been done 5 years ago. The reason that they have such large potential is that cold climate air source heat pumps have an enormous energy saving potential for those that use electric resistance and electric furnaces to heat their homes. It is the single largest residential measure by far. Although we are presenting the statewide potential here, the map also shows that there's a geographical distribution to electrically heated homes in Minnesota, with the largest concentration in the northwestern part of the state. Diving into the issue a little further, this is one type of cold climate air source heat pump called a mini split. When my wife and I remodeled our house about 5 years ago, our contractor recommended that we install a mini split, which is like a new concept for me. And so we've been using a mini split for cooling our home. And at the late in the spring and early in the fall, also for providing heating before we switch over to our gas-fired boiler for the hot water heating system. It can be used to heat a single room or multiple units can heat a whole home. It has an outside condenser compressor unit and an inside air handling unit or header that pumps out the hot or, in the summer, cold air. This technology saves energy by transferring heat from outside the home to the inside via vapor compression cycle, the same technology used by refrigerators and air conditioners. Air source heat pumps are pretty common in warmer climates for heating, but the cold climate version that works effectively down to 0 degrees or colder has only come on the market in recent years, so it's still a relatively new technology. As part of the potential study, the project team reviewed recent years of sales data for air source heat pumps. The data shows that contractors are not selling the most efficient versions of this technology, even though the high efficiency versions are not much more expensive. This is currently a gap in most utility programs. There's an opportunity for SIP programs to make a difference through trade ally outreach and effective incentive programs. For natural gas utilities, it is less dramatic of a turn from traditional energy efficiency sources. However, the residential sector with 40% of the potential is a more important sector than it is for electric utilities in general. Smart thermostats will become a larger part of the utility savings mix than currently. The project team found an existing saturation level of 7% in single-family homes from the primary data collection network. There's a lot of growth potential there. As smart thermostats are relatively new technology, and we are still learning about how they can be effective in saving energy, this technology will also be important from a research perspective to make sure that utility programs are promoting effective smart thermostat technology and that the savings is being claimed consistent with the latest evaluation research. And I can say that in connection with our own home remodeling, I installed Nest thermostats, but they're not directly designed for controlling hot water heating systems. They're more more effective with forced air. So our contractor had to insert a different set of controls in between the nests and our boiler in order, and the zone controls, in order to make this effective. So I can say from my own experience that there's a challenge in adapting these smart thermostats to different uses, and especially to adapting them into refurbished older homes. Here are the 11 specific recommendations that the project team developed for SIP programs to be able to capture the efficiency potential identified in the modeling. Many utilities in Minnesota are doing most or even all of these practices to some degree or another. I won't go into detail about them, but you can refer to the full report for more detail. Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the time. And Ms. Burdett and I would be happy to respond to questions.
There are questions. Representative Straczynski.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I got one question to the testifiers and then a second question to nonpartisan staff. Just kind of want an explanation kind of along the lines of the cost effectiveness of the SIP measures. So, like, as you're moving through the spectrum of things you can do from a cost effectiveness standpoint, you know, working with your partners, what have you, how do you measure that, and what have you seen?
Chair Guineas, Representative, thank you for the question. We look at cost effectiveness from a variety of perspectives. We look at the societal costs and benefits, the costs and benefits to utilities, participants, and the ratepayers. And within each of those perspectives, we balance the cost of the programs, the value of the energy savings, and ultimately determine based on those tests what is cost effective and what kind of program should be administered.
Thank you. And then this question is for staff. It's kind of an off-the-wall question a little bit, but kind of I serve on tax committee as well, and one of the issues we've been working with is regressive taxation. And, you know, one idea that we've been floating is taxation through regulation, essentially. And so when you look at whether it be increased costs in your utility bill through a regulatory process, you know, have we ever looked at what something that a committee like this could potentially do by expanding the SIP or energy efficiency or any number of things and look at a regressivity of that policy and see how it would affect people of lower incomes and their increased costs of the utility bill? Have we ever done any research like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Swinzinski, I don't believe we have done that kind of research.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and congratulations, Commissioner. I'm very excited for your tenure in this position. And I think that you did an excellent job of, I think, reminding us that energy efficiency is really the low-hanging fruit of how we can address a variety of issues, both in terms of building a strong economy and addressing climate and environment. And you started off by saying that the 1.5% standard is something that we, you know, met and have exceeded. And you laid out, you know, kind of over 9 years, how we can really even expand on that. Have you or the department or others discussed changing that numerical goal and increasing it and over certain specific time frames?
Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, in the 3 weeks I've been on the job, I can say that I have not discussed, had an opportunity to discuss with the governor whether the department would make any specific recommendations with respect to the SIP goals. I think the approach that I'd like to see the department take is to consult further with stakeholders and among our staff to see whether we can develop recommendations that might assist the governor in making his recommendations to the legislature for your consideration. One of the observations from the stakeholder participation in this study is that the stakeholders foresee challenges in the future with respect to meeting the SIP expectations, the SIP goals. And so we'd have to talk about the findings of the study in comparison to their perceptions of increased difficulty in achieving the SIP savings goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I hope that it'll be under consideration and discussion, because it seems to me that 1.5% is, we can do better than that, and I think other countries have done so as well. And as we have found out with the Renewable Energy Standard, when we do set numerical goals, people rally, and we can meet or exceed those. So I hope that in energy efficiency we can have that same, approaches we've taken to electric power generation. So thank you very much. And I also want to compliment you. I think this was a well-organized and very substantive presentation.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations, Commissioner Kelly. I'm curious on the report for the load projections. What types of assumptions were made about increasing electrification, either through electric vehicles or switching from gas to electric for cooking or heating? Was it assumed that we are currently, we essentially keep the same mix of those types of uses, or was there projected growth assumed in those areas?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, I'm going to hand this off to Ms. Burdett. I do want to note that she was responsible for overseeing the development of the project scope and the results. So with respect to the compliment that Representative Hornstein paid, the credit goes to her.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair Wagenius, Representative Long. In terms of projecting the future load, we relied on some existing information like integrated resource plans, projected sales from the utilities to make some determinations. With regard to electrification or fuel switching, like in the example you used for cooking equipment, we really didn't do a lot of kind of reading into the tea leaves on some of those market shifts or fuel switching, given some of the policy constraints that we currently have within the Conservation Improvement Program. Fuel switching is not something that is currently allowed to a large degree in SIP. And so I think that that's a next logical step in taking some of the analysis that's been completed to date and understanding some of the interactive market effects as we look at electrification of the transportation system, electrification of end-use technologies, particularly around like the air source heat pumps and commercial kitchen equipment or residential kitchen equipment. So I think it's a good question, and that's something we intend to follow up on.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, as I've been learning about the results of the report and discussing this with Ms. Burdett, one of the opportunities of the new technologies like the air source cold climate air source heat pumps is that it could give consumers in Minnesota additional energy efficient and cost effective choices with respect to fuels. So for example, with these air source heat pumps, consumers who previously felt that propane might be a more efficient or cost-effective way of heating their homes may have an additional option that could be better, and it would be a legislative consideration whether to incorporate fuel switching into the SIP program.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will also congratulate Commissioner Kelly on his appointment. My question is about engagement, and you are doing obviously some great work in the Conservation Improvement Program, and you talked about this next decade plan, and that there are some low-hanging fruit that have been already reached, and yet there's still work to be done on lighting issues. Or you also talked about some best practices and some new innovative techniques. And I'm just wondering what strategies you have or partnerships you have to try and help that engagement. We all know that, you know, education is, or knowledge is power, and so how can we help other people do better?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. The Conservation Improvement Program relies very heavily on partnerships with trade allies and other providers to provide outreach to different customers. You know, we have low-income customers, large industrial customers, and so it requires a wide array of partnerships to be able to engage customers to implement efficiency. You'll hear a little bit from Clean Energy Resource Teams today, who has been a partner in the Conservation Improvement Program for quite some time, and they we'll talk a little bit about how they work regionally through extension, as well as with the utilities who do have a hard time working with their customers to implement efficiency. And so in terms of, you know, strategies over the next 10 years, I think it really we will have to depend and strengthen those partnerships to conduct the outreach and meet customers where they are and allow them to make the choices that best meet their needs. And I think with that, too, is also utility partnerships, electric utilities partnering with gas utilities. Most of us probably have both electric and natural gas service in our homes and possibly by two different utilities. And when we have those utility partnerships across fuel sources, it can lead to better collaborative engagement with the customer and make things easier for them to make choices about their efficiency as it relates to their home needs or their business needs.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Kelly, I hope you're enjoying your new job as much as I. You made reference to that you installed a mini split and you use it in the spring and in the fall. My question is on these cold climate air source heat pumps, do you know what the cutoff point is when they can no longer create heat for the outdoor ambient temperature?
Madam Chair, Representative, do you mean like if it's 20 below zero? Ms. Burdett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I could not tell you right off the top of my head the answer, but if I had one staff person sitting next to me, I could punt to that staff person. So we can get back to you rather quickly with that information.
Madam Chair, I can say that I actually operate one of these and mine cuts out about 18 degrees. Beyond that, it cannot work. And where I live, dual fuel is very important. As was it 5-6 years ago, propane skyrocketed and was not even available. So if that technology can be improved, according to my HVAC gentleman, he's hot rodded as hard as he can, and it's the best it'll do. Thank you.
I see no other questions. Thank you all. I appreciate your helping us out.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We'll be visiting later, I am sure. Next, we have Center for Energy and the Environment. I understand we have about 20 minutes for each presentation. Is that your understanding? So there will be time for questions.
That is our understanding. And thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Maybe just give us a quick second here to get our presentation switched over. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Sullivan. I am the manager of legislative and external relations at the Center for Energy and Environment, and sitting next to me is my colleague, Jamie Fitzke. We're going to split up the presentation. I'll take the first half, and Jamie will carry on with the second half. A little bit about us here. If you're interested, we're very happy to be with you today to give you a brief but hopefully lasting overview of the Center for Energy and Environment and some of the work we do to promote Minnesota's cost-effective energy efficiency programs in the state. So a little bit about CEE. CEE, Center for Energy and Environment, is Minnesota's oldest and largest clean energy nonprofit. We're located here in the Twin Cities. We have been around for about 40 years, and we have about 150 people who work on energy efficiency research, program delivery, and policy development. We are a data-driven and community-based and consumer-focused organization, and we work to discover and deploy the most effective solutions for a healthy, low-carbon economy. Our unofficial motto at CEE is we get our hands dirty for clean energy, and that's because our staff wear hard hats, they work with contractors and building maintenance folks, and we are focused on results, the results of energy efficiency. So this is a little bit, we're focused in Minneapolis and or we're focused in Minnesota, but we work throughout the country. So our impact is, you know, we've done work and projects in California, Florida, Virginia, Texas. So we are, we're throughout, we do a lot of work throughout the country, but most of our work is in Minnesota. And our focus is really, we think of it as kind of three parts. Our focus fundamentally is about reducing energy waste, from reducing excess energy consumption and utility fuel use to reducing customer costs that are higher than necessary for the services that are provided. And we do this through an integrated, comprehensive approach that starts with technical research. All of our programs are founded in the research that we do at CEE, and that helps us better understand and verify the energy savings potentials of various technologies and processes. We then integrate those into the programs and services that we offer, which we'll talk about in a minute here. And then that informs the legislative and the policy work that we do here. So this is a kind of this virtuous cycle that we think about. It's this boots on the ground experience that informs the policies that we advocate here at the Capitol and with our regulatory agencies, Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission. Here's some examples of some of the technical research that we have done. You know, and as I had said, all of our work starts with our technical field research. We have a staff of PhDs and research engineers that are unmatched outside of the National Energy Labs. We actually have a rocket scientist on staff. She came from NASA to work for CEE, so we're very proud of that. She loves it that we talk about that all the time, too. But our researchers partner with utilities, with research organizations, universities, and others to assess savings and performance characteristics of the specific energy policy or the specific energy approaches in the building envelope, duct leakage, HVAC systems, indoor air quality, and energy feedback and behavior. We have, as Commissioner Kelly was just speaking about, we have recently completed, in collaboration with the Department of Commerce and Minnesota's utilities, the Minnesota Energy Efficiency Potential Study, which you know, this study has assessed the energy efficiency potential for Minnesota through the next decade. You know, a little bit more about the programs and services that we deliver. You know, we run and operate programs for our utilities. You know, we design and implement programs that Minnesotans utilize at their home and their work. It's really as simple as that. You know, the programs that we run, we offer for, you know, and work with Xcel Energy, CenterPoint. We've worked with Rochester Public Utilities, Minnesota Energy Resources. We also do a significant amount of work with building owners and managers to help them better understand and optimize their energy use to improve the operation of their equipment and their systems. And we also provide financing. We do financing for energy efficiency projects. When people are, you know, opening up their building or opening up their house, that's a time when they often need loans. So we do a significant amount of lending for efficiency and for solar projects. We've also, to your question, Representative, about engagement, we do a significant amount of engagement with cities throughout the state. We have worked with the City of Minneapolis, with Red Wing, City of Maplewood, Shorewood, Winona, Faribault. I think we've worked with 18 cities at this point on the Partners in Energy program, which we work on with Xcel Energy. It's a very successful program. Some of the award-winning programs that we have actually just recently won awards for, we're very proud of. But this month, we were opened by the American Council for an Energy Efficiency, Energy Efficient Economy. We were awarded three exemplary energy efficiency programs. This is a prestigious prestigious designation that comes after a nationwide review by ACEEE, and it takes place once every 5 years. So we're very proud of this. Our one-stop efficiency program is a program that we operate for small businesses. This is a lighting and HVAC program. The most important thing that this program does is it saves these customers, it has saved them over $800 million in electric utility costs. So very, very successful program. Jamie is one of our experts on that program. We also run the Home Energy Squad program. So for any folks who in the room who have had a home energy audit and you are in Xcel's and CenterPoint service territory, the people who come to your house are people who work at the Center for Energy and Environment. And then Xcel Energy's Partners in Energy program. Recently won an award for that program as well. We're very proud of this work. Some of the advanced energy projects that we do, these are programs that, we have, we're funded to work on are the Minnesota Solar Pathways Study. This project is a program that we've done in collaboration with the United States Department of Energy, in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the Great Plains Institute, electric utilities, and electric and consumer advocates. And the goal of the Solar Pathway Study is to identify the least risk, best value pathways to achieving Minnesota's goal of having 10% of its electricity come from solar. Another project that we've done in collaboration with Evergreen Energy was an assessment of the sustainable energy options for the Destination Medical Center in Rochester. This is a project towards creating a zero-carbon DMC zone in Rochester. My colleague, Mike Bull, co-directs a nation-leading project with Rolf Nordstrom at the Great Plains Institute known as the Minnesota E21 Initiative. This initiative is a project that is, we work with our electric utilities, our gas utilities, to find the next, updating and working on the business model for electric utilities. And finally, we've done a significant amount of work on strategic electrification for water and space heating in buildings. And we're using our 40 years of experience working in buildings, the building stock in Minnesota, to show how we can electrify our system. Commissioner Kelly did a great job of testifying to the history of our conservation programs. One of the things that we like to talk about at CE is that the Conservation Improvement Program is Minnesota's most successful energy efficient or energy policy. Now, some people might debate that, but what it is for sure is it is absolutely Minnesota's oldest, most bedrock energy policy. It, starting in 1980, and the program has evolved over the decades. To today, where we have a 1.5% savings goal for all of our utilities, our electric utilities, and 1% for our gas utilities. Tremendously successful program. And we at CE have a hard time, and everybody does, of putting a face on energy efficiency. Jamie likes to call efficiency the silent hero of the clean energy community. And it is that. But I will posit that this is the face of the conservation program. This is the face of energy efficiency. Is energy efficiency has levelized, it has reduced our electric sales growth. And you can see that up to 2007, with the passage of the Next Generation Energy Act and our conservation standard, that Minnesota's electric sales were growing. And now Minnesota's electric sales are essentially flat. Now that poses some challenges for our utilities, but it is unquestionably a good thing for society, and we are very proud of that, and that is the success of Minnesota's conservation program. And with that, I'm going to kick it over to Jamie, and she can talk a little bit more about the program itself.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you, members of the committee. Much of the work we do at CEE comes under the Minnesota Conservation Improvement Program, or CIP for short. As Joe mentioned, energy efficiency has been in place for almost 30 years and has been Minnesota's most successful energy policy since rural electrification. We work with utilities around the state to help their customers identify and implement energy efficiency measures so that their businesses are more competitive and their homes are more comfortable. We estimate that Minnesotans have saved over $6 billion in the last 20 years. This is mainly through power plants that haven't had to been built and then that customers haven't had to pay for. CIP supports over 47,000 Minnesota jobs. And CIP contributes 14% of Minnesota's electricity demand. So 14% of our electricity needs are met through energy efficiency. The benefits of energy efficiency are numerous. You're likely aware that energy efficiency programs allow utility customers to control their energy bills. This is especially important for low income or those who are on a fixed income. But it also avoids or delays additional utility infrastructure. With this helps utilities save money, but that means then all utility members save money because that avoided infrastructure isn't taking place. It also reduces the wholesale cost of power supply by reducing demand. And these investments, they stay local and come back into the community. The energy savings from an energy efficiency project allow customers to spend their money on other things. And these projects are almost always done by local contractors. Additionally, energy efficiency reduces greenhouse gas emissions. By using energy more efficiently, less fossil fuel is burned, and fewer greenhouse gases are emitted. Energy efficiency is the silent hero of our clean energy transition. In October, ACEEE, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, released their 12th annual State Energy Efficiency Scorecard. This reviews and ranks state success in energy efficiency based on programs, policies, and progress. Partially due to our state's strong energy efficiency policies and successful utility customer participation in CIP, Minnesota consistently ranks in the top 10 and is the only non-coastal state in the top 10. Minnesota's high ranking is especially impressive given how cost-effective our programs are compared to other high-ranking states. Minnesota has the lowest program cost. This ACEEE chart reflects the cost of first-year savings, not lifetime energy efficiency savings. And I'm going to explain this just a bit. The lifetime savings would be much lower. For example, the average lifetime of most energy efficiency equipment are about 10 to 14 years or greater, like an air conditioner or light fixture. They last much longer than just 1 year. So conservatively, at 10 years and at 19 cents per kWh of a first-year savings, this would be then 1.9 cents over the lifetime of that equipment, which is the more accurate way to reflect the cost and energy savings and useful life of an energy efficiency measure. So just wanted to make that clear on that chart. This graph might look familiar, as it's been part of a few other previous committee presentations. This is the Lazard levelized cost of energy analysis with energy efficiency added. When compared to traditional energy generation sources, energy efficiency is one of, if not the, most cost-effective resource. Keeping in mind, the chart reflects levelized costs across the U.S., with the average cost of energy efficiency around 3 cents per kWh. Minnesota utilities are operating some of the most cost-effective programs and are below the national average at 1.9 cents per kWh. This slide reflects technologies a few efficiency programs focus on. This ranges from lighting retrofits, HVAC systems, water heating, building recommissioning, to name a few. And a great design of our CIP policy is it's not static. All those blue circles, they're able to change over time. So when a new technology comes onto the market that is energy efficient and market ready, it becomes one of those blue circles. Conversely, as a technology becomes maybe baseline, the standard, or the code minimum, then it goes off. So then shifting to the large circle, we think of energy efficiency as a resource utilities buy from their customers through efficiency incentives. To help visualize, we created this graphic to depict how energy efficiency contributes to our energy needs. Taken together, SIP captures enough energy efficiency to meet 14% of our electric needs. That is the same amount of electricity generated by natural gas. So utilities can either purchase generation at around 8 cents per kWh or purchase efficiency around 2 cents. And they can do that through purchasing it as a resource from their customers, through rebates to encourage their customers to purchase more efficient appliances and utility and building investments. And these incentives to acquire efficiency are much or the least cost. Additionally, energy efficiency helps right-size the grid, which encourages faster integration and a higher percentage of renewables onto our system. So far, we've presented the aggregate big picture of what SIP is doing for Minnesota. Now I'll take a quick look at a few of the committee's members' districts. It's more granular. So instead of the dozens of SIP programs available, this focuses on the two programs Joe mentioned earlier, the One-Stop Lighting Program and the Home Energy Squad. This map shows all the project work CEE has done in District 63B. I want to stress that this map shows projects attributed to just two SIP programs, and there are many SIP programs operating in Cherwaginius' district and throughout the state. And through these two programs, over 1,300 home energy audits have been completed and almost 160 small business lighting retrofits. Each of these dots represents a homeowner or business that have increased their energy productivity, reduced their energy costs, and reduced their carbon footprint. These are homes, retailers, schools, manufacturers, and churches. The projects done here are saving Cherwaginius' district over $450,000 every year. Energy efficiency is fundamentally about doing the same or more with less energy. These 1,500 dots represent people using their energy savings to put money back into their personal pockets or their businesses' budgets and provide utilities with the least cost resource. In Representative Bowe's district, we've done 73 small business lighting retrofits and 113 home energy squad visits, saving his constituents over $200,000 per year. And to help visualize the energy savings equivalent, the kilowatt hours saved through efficiency are close to 5 football fields of solar. Representative Bowe's district is serviced by a few electric utilities, which is common in many of your districts. While these numbers are impressive, they are only telling a fraction of the energy efficiency story taking place here. And moving east, we have Representative Christensen's district. In District 39B, we have completed nearly 500 projects, and these projects are saving almost $800,000 per year for the people who live and work here. Additionally, carbon dioxide is reduced because less fossil fuel is being burned. In District 39B, that equates to over 14 million pounds of CO2 reduced, equivalent to 1,060 cars. And to kind of conclude our SIP in your district tour, I included the efficiency work CEE has done through these two programs across the House Energy and Climate Committee member districts. We have done more than 8,600 projects. The energy produced from energy efficiency equals a 50-megawatt solar farm. 50-megawatt solar farm. The CO2 savings equates to removing over 9,000 cars from the road. And we are saving the business and constituents here over $7 million per year. All of this through two SIP programs. The members that we have yet to meet with, we will be providing a SIP-specific district map for you too. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to highlight the efficiency work. And I'll turn this back to Joe for a few last comments.
So thank you, Jamie. And I do think it's worth mentioning, I know Jamie did, that is just two programs. There are many programs. So this is a tremendously important program when you throw it all together, and that is why it's 14% of our electric system. So, you know, we have two legislative initiatives this year, an energy conservation and optimization. We have a legislative initiative around that. Basically, it's to integrate efficient fuel switching and demand response into the conservation program, and then our clean energy first construct, which is would require that when electric utilities have forecasted need for new generation, that they first look to clean energy resources. And with that, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed the presentation about CEE and efficiency, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'll start off with the first question. Tell me about your work in K-12 schools.
Chair Reganius, the work that we do in K-12 schools as a part of, and I can, Jamie has done actual projects in K-12 schools, but we've done a significant amount of lighting projects in schools. Actually, one of the tours that we do, conservation improvement tours for legislators with Representative Mahoney, was at a school in St. Paul. But Jamie has a little bit more information as well.
Specifically through many of the school districts, what we'll look to do is do a full lighting and occasionally a full building analysis. From that, then we'll take the information of what they're using from an energy standpoint, what they could do to become more energy efficient, and then help them implement that. With that, we'll also put together some recommendations. Those are third-party, non-biased recommendations, and then also what the schools would qualify for rebates or incentives. We've seen a significant uptake in many schools moving from traditional lighting systems to LEDs and then also integrating controls. They can save a significant amount of money from going through and doing energy efficiency measures.
I ask because I have schools in my district that were insulated for sound, which makes them extremely energy efficient. And one of my schools, the first one that was insulated for sound, I visited a couple of years ago. I mean, it's been insulated for maybe 25 years. And the boiler operator said she only used one of the two boilers. But the most important thing she told those of us that were visiting is that she had to clean her air filters just regularly. She exchanged them regularly. But she also was bragging to us that this Minneapolis school was the healthiest school in the district, that they had the least absenteeism. So moving from lighting to something far more sophisticated could have, I don't know whether I would want to call it unintended benefits, but certainly very strong benefits, since school absenteeism for things like asthma is really high.
Madam Chair, often we refer to those as the non-energy benefits that people receive through energy efficiency.
Okay. Representative Swiecinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question. During your presentation, you had about 150 employees. Was I correct? And I'm just kind of wondering, what's your, for 150 employees, what's your budget, and then where does that money mostly come from?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Swiecinski. We are a large organization, and our budget is around $19 million, and we have forecasted, we have revenues of about $19 million. Our money comes from fee-for-service, working with utilities and with building owners, and we, earn those revenues through the project work and delivering programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So fee-for-service, so what percentage, do some research, it sounds like, what percentage of your budget of the $19 million would you say is the fee-for-service, and then what would be your, I know you get some money from the university for some research. Like, what would be your percentage of a, just as an organization?
Madam Chair, Representative Swiecinski, I have to get back to you on that specific breakdown.
Thank you. And just one last thing, Madam Chair, just kind of talking a little bit, and maybe you could answer this as well to the testifiers, but talking about low-hanging fruit, it's often, you know, we've heard that a number of times, like, you know, we really, you know, grasp a lot of that. I mean, is that kind of a code word for most cost-efficient work?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, you know, the low-hanging fruit as a phrase, I think, you know, we like to say at CE that low-hanging fruit grows back. And, you know, there is a lot of efficiency out there. So I don't really think of it as a code word. I just think of it as a kind of a shorthand for, you know, there's a lot of efficiency that can be, you know, picked up. And if you have good programs and you have good people and you have willing partners, you know, there's a lot of opportunity out there.
Thank you. Madam Chair, to the testifier, you said willing partners. Do you think this work would be done without a mandate? Would you be in support of, you know, it sounds like this is really a popular thing with the utilities you work with. Would you be more of an incentive-based program, or do you feel as an organization you need a mandate to do this?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, the, you know, conservation, although it's the lowest cost resource, is something that good programs follow from having a goal in place. And in our view, a goal is absolutely essential to putting together the programs that are necessary to deliver efficiency effectively.
Okay. We have three questions, then we're going to move on so we make sure we cover everything. Representative Acomb.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine's quick. Slide 17, there's a graph on cost effectiveness of energy efficiency. And I guess I was surprised by the rating of community solar, and maybe you can help explain why that is looked at as maybe less cost effective than the utility solar. And I understand scale. Maybe just help me understand.
I'll address as best as possible. I am by no means a community solar expert. But from what I understand is there are some regulations in place that determined some of the costs of the energy that's being purchased back from the utility, and that helps kind of increase some of the price with it. Utility scale solar, as you can see to the left by three, that's just maybe done at a larger scale, and like anything, higher scale, lower cost.
And then actually just one other question while I, if you have my aids, it'll be quick. There's the table two pages before that with our score of 8 and that we're doing so well, and we're the only one kind of in our area that are. We're surrounded by a lot. But knowing by states with a lot higher scores, knowing we're not an island, are we working in partnership and knowing that we're partnering with Excel and other organizations that go beyond our boundaries, are we working to try and improve those scores as well to, or at least partner to offer information, mentor maybe?
I would say CEE does partner with a lot of organizations throughout the country. We kind of look at it as we might be a think tank, but we also want to make sure that we're sharing our intelligence and our resources throughout the country, particularly other Midwest states and other organizations, nonprofits who are energy efficiency motivated, we do look to partner with.
Thank you, that's great.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the benefits of energy efficiency to low-income customers, and you know, low-income customers in Minnesota are often living in the least efficient homes or dwellings and see some of the highest relative costs of energy. Curious if you could expand on that a little bit. What benefits have you seen for the SIP and energy efficiency programs to low-income customers?
Part of the, I'd say, the best benefit from it is through energy efficiency. Most low-income residents have the highest energy burden, and that's because if you're on a fixed income or a low income, a larger percentage of your income has to go to affording energy. What we look to do, particularly for the low income, is to try to make sure that all the measures that can be implemented are. One of the largest hurdles to overcome would be the owner-renter disincentive that's taking place. And I know that there's some discussions on how we can try to get move past these barriers.
Personally, if anybody has any ideas, I think it would be great to hear them because it is really instrumental for us to make sure that low-income people are being serviced as they need it the greatest.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Joseph and Jamie, for the presentation. I wanted to go back to your home audits and ask just a little bit about the incentives. I understand that a lot of those incentives are coming from the energy companies in the form of rebates. Are there other incentives built in or that have been effective over the years as far as tax credits directly to consumers? Because I think that economic piece is the most central to this whole thing, to get people to change, which is what we're up against here. And I just wondered about also in the conversation about what other states are doing. Are there programs in other states that have worked exceedingly well that we could transplant here?
Okay, I'll try to get through a few of those questions. If I missed one, please let me know. From the residential perspective, there's a suite of programs that are offered, same for commercial. But with residential, there are the incentives through a rebate. Also through Home Energy Squad, they do a great job of having direct install. So when they're on site, they do the weather stripping. They let you know where you need insulation. They put in energy efficient light bulbs. So there are a few options available through that method. Then speaking to the financial aspect, particularly if we're going to be looking at some other federal options, and that's really where there are some additional incentives. There is something called 179D, and that works as an accelerated tax depreciation for businesses. It's kind of complicated because, you know, anything that involves taxes are. And then also with that, there are some certain areas that would qualify for REAP grants, which is through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they specifically look at rural areas and then also farming. And with that, they offer grants to help cover energy efficiency studies, renewable energy studies, and then also grants to help install energy efficiency and renewables. So there are some additional options out there.
Thank you all so much. I appreciate it. We are now going to go on to our third topic.
Thank you.
Group.
Thank you very much.
Clean energy resource teams, we have about 20 minutes with questions. So
I'll just raise my hand now.
Madam Chair, committee members, while we pull this up, how about we do our introductions and we'll try to condense our time. My name is Lissa Polish, and I work as the statewide director of the Clean Energy Resource Teams, and I'm based at the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships and Extension. And I'll introduce my colleague, Diana.
Good morning. My name is Diana McEwen, and I serve as the director for the Metro, 11-county metro region of CERT's Clean Energy Resource Teams, and I'm based at the Great Plains Institute, our nonprofit partner.
We hope it won't be too distracting, but Diana and I like to tag team, and we really are going to go back and forth. We are both fast talkers, so if you need us to slow down, give us a sign, but we're going to try to move quickly through this so that we have time for questions. So we gave you two just bits of paper in addition to your slides. One is a quick fact sheet about what CERT is, and we're going to cover that briefly. Another is a highlights of our 2018 annual report. Diana.
So CERT is not a program and an organization, or it's not an organization, it's a program. It's a partnership. We are a statewide partnership. We were launched in 2003 and expanded to include the metro region in 2007 when I came on board. We cover the whole state through a partnership across seven different regions, and we have regional staff and steering committees in each of those regions. We have multiple partners to draw from those resources. Each partner has a constituency that trusts them. We do good research and are nimble with our programming, and we have broad-based support across the state. So what are we all about? We are about people helping people, and that includes individuals, business, local governments. Try to get clean energy done in ways that work and make sense for communities. We do not mandate what communities might do. We come to them and meet them where they're at. This is people and place-based work. We don't have a one-size-fits-all strategy. We work with people to shape those strategies.
CERTS was written into statute in 2007, and we have about half of our funding, or $500,000 annually, that comes through the Conservation Applied Research and Development Fund, as described here. In addition, we leverage other resources, be they from contracts for service, federal agency funding from the U.S. Department of Energy or U.S. Department of Agriculture, as well as private philanthropic foundations. That's really all we're going to tell you about CERTS as an overview, and we're just going to dive into a few highlights and accomplishments. That 2018 overview is a sort of distilled version of an annual report that we submit every year. And we're going to just hit on a couple of highlights. We really think about our work in a number of different ways. We measure our success based on some energy savings that we can deliver, always done in partnership and collaboration with communities, with utilities, with the service providers that many of the other presenters have talked about today. We do seed grants. We have seed grants that are offered in each region of the state, so each of those seven regions, and the funding is determined by local steering committees who have a sense for sort of what some of the challenges and issues are on the ground and then can help direct funding toward those projects. We do a lot of events. We really feel like it's important to meet people where they are. We host a number of our own events, and so we highlighted a couple of things like our statewide conference that we do every other year in St. Cloud that attracts about 500 folks. People jokingly refer to it as the community energy prom. No one actually dresses up in that way, but it's a chance for people to actually just get together and talk shop. We also host events in each of our regions, and then we do a lot of presentations. And some of those are joint presentations, like partnering up with a local utility to go and present at a Rotary chapter. We participate in Farm Fest, all sorts of other events where we're trying to meet people where they already are to help get them information, but also to provide us a chance to actually listen and hear what people are talking about, what their concerns are, what their needs are, and what they might need to help move forward. This image gives you just a quick snapshot of a number of the communities that we've worked in just the past year. So this is 204 communities that we've been reaching out to, working with, partnering. Those with bigger font just represent communities that we've spent more time in, more people that we've engaged, more specific efforts that we've advanced with those places. We think about our work along audiences, really trying to figure out for different groups, they have different priorities. And if we can tailor our resources to something that works in that sort of peer environment, we're bound to be more effective. And so as a starting point, we do a lot of work with governmental units. And this is largely cities, increasingly more tribal nations. Much of our city work is done in conjunction with a program called Green Step. And there's a Green Step Cities as well as a Green Step Tribal Nations program. We always start with energy efficiency. And that is obviously the theme of this whole session. One of the things that we talk a lot about is benchmarking and making sure that people are able to actually measure their usage so they have a sense of how much they use. Use that to then prioritize the work that they do, and then track the improvements that they've been able to make in those facilities. These are actually pictures from Minnesota State University Mankato, where we hosted an event this fall. This is the second event that we've hosted around B3, or Buildings Benchmarks and Beyond, a state benchmarking system, where we talk about the value of benchmarking for just getting a handle on your energy usage. That in and of itself can help you save energy because all of a sudden you're paying attention. And then walk through efficiency options as well as financing. The first event that we hosted like this was in Orinoco about a year ago. And I'll tell you that I've been with CERTS for 15 years. And when we first started hosting energy efficiency events, it was like pulling teeth to get somebody to come. You would have about 10 people show up. And if we hosted an event about wind, 120 would come. We've had 50 people, 60 people turn out to these energy efficiency events over the last couple of years, and I think it's because people are realizing this is money that they can just put back in their pocket and actually deliver that back to their actual programming and their mission. The other thing I'll just mention, most of our events that we host often involve some sort of tour component. Everybody wants to, just like if somebody has an open house, everyone wants to go tour the home and take a look inside. The same thing happens with all sorts of energy events. People want to take a look at the technology. They want to hear from the facilities manager. They want to just dig into it. And at the end of this tour at Minnesota State University Mankato, I'm sorry, I always get that wrong because they recently changed it, we were delighted to see that they have their own EV charging sign up, because it seems with all of our energy work, all roads lead back to EVs.
So one of the projects we've been doing across the state with governmental units, specifically cities, is a project called Cities Charging Ahead, which I'm honored to lead statewide. It's something where we have pulled together a peer cohort of cities that want to work, learn, and explore and take action together to become EV or electric vehicle ready communities. Some of the exciting things that have been going on that have led to this is, you know, now Pine City has a charging station, so you can get up the corridor and get up to the North Shore with an electric vehicle, which is very exciting. We have a couple of cities, you know, you'll see the chart in a minute here, but we have a couple cities like the city of Hastings that we connected to a fleet karma study with Xcel Energy, the city of Eagan, which has recently purchased a Mitsubishi Outlander, which is a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, SUV. It's become a popular replacement. We are really focused on helping those cities, and the next chart will show the cities. There are 28 across the state, and for 28 cities, that's a pretty good spread, considering there are 855 odd cities in the state of Minnesota. So we're excited. Obviously, many of them are in the metro, but not all. And you'll notice some of the other standouts in Greater Minnesota: Morris, Hackensack, and Warren. And in Warren, we have a rock star city administrator that drives an electric vehicle and has been participating with the community smart municipalities project, and used a drone for some thermal imaging for buildings. So very exciting.
We also do a lot of work directly with Minnesota utilities. And as was talked about by the first couple of presenters, a lot of that partnership is really important in terms of actually driving programmatic adoption. Over the last year, we decided to actually put brass tacks to the work that we do with utilities and create a very simple menu of services that really helps the utility understand what are the things that we can do with and for you. And it's broken into a couple of different categories, sort of helping deliver energy savings, supporting your staff, and then helping promote your existing efforts. And just to give you a couple of examples of what that looks like, so we run a campaign called Saving Watts and Drops. We like to come up with really cute, kitschy names for nearly anything that we do. And this one is really focused on what we call sort of plug-and-play devices, so sort of light bulbs, faucet aerators, that kind of thing. And we worked in partnership with both Austin and Owatonna Municipal Utilities this past year. They were going to do a faucet aerator giveaway. This results in both gas and water savings, but they wanted some educational tools to go along with that to actually talk to people about why this mattered, where these savings actually came through. And so we helped them deliver these, you know, just cute graphic images of what it looks like to save water and gas. We've also developed what's called a Right Light Guide. We actually first developed this back in 2012. This was to help explain to people how to buy a light bulb at the hardware store. Many of you probably share in the pain of that experience, and actually it's getting a lot more streamlined, right? Because now we're all a little more familiar with what we're looking for in terms of the temperature Kelvin of the bulb and all of that. But we put together this guide to help people go to the hardware store and make a good decision about their bulbs. But when we did this, we also made it available to utilities to brand with their own identity. And so you see that the version on the left is My Energy. They're a cooperative based in southeastern Minnesota. And the version on the right is actually elements of our Right Light Guide put into Minn Kota Power's Power Saver book. They put out a calendar, a planner, essentially, for all of the contractors with whom they work in their entire service territory, and they've adapted our lighting tools to go into that guide to make sure that all of their providers have that same resource and information. And we just provide this to them as a matter of course. In a related way, we've started to do much more work with underserved audiences or low-income audiences. And all of this work is, again, done in collaboration with utilities. And there are a few examples here. You'll notice that we also mentioned that we've partnered with Center for Energy and the Environment, the previous testifiers. There's so much work to be done and so much good opportunity to go around. The project mentioned on the far left is with Minnesota Energy Resources. This was a multifamily housing program that involved direct install of technologies. We were able to do outreach to 44 different properties, 14 of which moved forward from 8 different communities, actually installing energy-efficient equipment in 440 households or units. We were also able to help Minnesota Energy Resources connect with Minnesota Power, the local electric utility, so that they were able to get both the gas and electric savings, another concept that was mentioned earlier today, to make sure that they were able to deliver on that. And one of the things that we find through all of this work is that there are multiple service territories in many different communities. So the example on the far right is of Silver Bay. That involves Co-op Light and Power as well as Minnesota Power, and the offerings are different, but we partnered with the North Shore Area Partners, a community group that works with seniors, to deliver utility services and make sure that those residents were connected to those programs to be able to move forward.
And I just want to say, one of the things that we often say about ourselves is that we're a partnership that likes to partner. We're very partnery. So one other specific project related to underserved communities and small business, Great Plains Institute and me with MetroCert this past year had a contract with the city of Minneapolis to run a review process for applications for a green cost share program that they have where they do matching funds to businesses for energy efficiency and solar projects. And it was a very exciting project. We did outreach to the potential committee members, created the scoring tool, reviewed the proposals, and we're also going to be writing some case studies as those projects complete, and we have some numbers to share. At this point, the 2018 numbers, we had 31 energy projects at 30 sites. Nine of them were in green zones, which Minneapolis identifies as underserved communities, environmental justice communities in Minneapolis. The city funded about $1 million, and with that matching grant and the funds the businesses put in, it was a total of about $12 million with the matching funds of investment that went into businesses for energy efficiency and solar projects that they wanted to pursue. So it's very exciting. And we were just beginning the 2019 process and already had one round with a number of projects that have been going forward. So we also, one of the other ways that we work in the small business audience category is we do business blitzes. And what that means is we partner up with a community, a utility, mostly has been electric utilities in the past. We've recently, in the last couple of years, partnered also with CenterPoint Energy and doing blitzes across 561 blitzes on Main Street with businesses, six with Otter Tail, two with Xcel Energy, Faribault, Fertile, Halleck, Parker's Prairie, Pelican Rapids, we can go on, lots of different projects in communities and working with businesses. We also have done a lot of work with the Property Assessed Clean Energy program of financing, PACE, and so very excited to be working along with that. And then one last thing, we did have help with the first bank relighting with the LED lights in St. Paul last year.
And how about we just close there? We have more slides. We can just stop, and we'll take your questions. And if maybe they refer to a slide, we'll bring it back up.
We have about 2 minutes for questions.
You're good.
Okay. If you want to give 2 more slides, and then we have two folks who've signed up to testify about efficiency, and I'd like to get to them.
So the only other things that we wanted to make sure that we mention is that we also do a good bit of work in the agricultural sector. We have run a number of campaigns over the last number of years. We had one called Gobble Up Savings. You can guess what the target audience was for that. Another, Milk the Savings. You can gather a theme. And we have a recent work effort that's been called Hog the Energy Savings. Anything for a pun. But this is really important because I feel like agriculture is a sector that doesn't get quite as much attention and love on the energy efficiency front. And part of that is related to the fact that, people are spread out and farmers have a lot to do on a day-to-day basis that is well beyond thinking about energy. The economy for agriculture has been in rough shape the last number of years, and that continues to move forward. One of the things that we focus on is how do we connect as many resources as possible? So Jamie had mentioned the USDA Rural Energy for America program, or REAP program. PACE funding is another one of those tools. How do we help bundle resources and get them to farmers and connect them with other programs like Great River Energy's audit program so that they know how much energy they're using, they know where they can save energy, and then they know how they can actually bundle the financing to make those projects happen without it affecting their day-to-day income stream?
Thank you all so much. I mean, you've given us lots of things to think about and lots more opportunities that need to be taken Representative Hornstein. With that, Ken Smith has signed up to testify. We have about 2 minutes, and then one more testifier, Jesse Turk, if he would be ready.
Yes. Good morning, Welcome Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you this morning. And you've heard many things about how we are improving our energy efficiency as a state and many measurable results that are quite good. But there are a few other measures that I think show that Minnesota's got some work to do. There are two measures that I track that point to Minnesota needing to examine its approach to energy efficiency, and those are overall system efficiency and energy productivity. Overall system efficiency is all the prime energy that we use, prime energy being renewables, fossil fuels, nuclear. So all of the prime energy that we use, and what do we get out of it? What kind of work does it produce? The data from the Department of Energy, Lawrence Livermore National Labs, these flow diagrams, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, indicate that Minnesota, the most recent data indicates that Minnesota wastes 57% of its prime energy. In fact, if you look at the data that's available from Lawrence Livermore National Labs, we wasted 57% in 2010, we wasted 57% in 2012, we wasted 57% in 2014. We are consistently wasting 57% of our prime energy as a state. And I think we can do better. The other measure I mentioned is energy productivity. Energy productivity is if you take the GDP of a state, it can be of a business, it can be a state or of a country, and you divide into that all of the prime energy that economy uses. That's energy productivity. As a state, our energy productivity has plateaued. It increased for many years, but it now has plateaued. So we need to ask ourselves some questions why that is happening. And so while we are producing measurable results, we're saving BTUs, we're saving kilowatt hours, we're making devices more efficient, we aren't necessarily making our overall system more efficient. And we need to think about that as you're thinking about changes to our policy, changes to our the programs that result of that. We need to step back and think more holistically about what else should we be measuring and tracking progress as a state. And I would encourage us to look at the overall efficiency and energy productivity. Such solutions, to think about these holistic solutions, often require partnership. It is taking wasted energy from one area and using it in another area, but it's also frequently, from our work, the most carbon reduction solutions that you also will achieve. As a kid growing up in Minnesota, I would hear from my grandparents and parents, waste not, want not. I would also hear that one person's waste is another person's treasure. I think those are good thoughts for us to be thinking about. How do we work more holistically to improve the overall efficiency of our energy system and improve the energy productivity of our energy system, and that we maximize the economic value we gain out of every BTU and every kilowatt hour our economy consumes? Thank you.
Thank you. Jesse Turk.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jesse Turk. I'm an architect, husband, father of three young kids, and a St. Paul resident. I work at BWBR. We're one of the largest and oldest architecture firms in the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the American Institute of Architects in Minnesota. I grew up on a small farm in central Minnesota near Litchfield. We raised crops, hogs, and Christmas trees, and this instilled in me at an early age the love of nature and conservation. Over the years, I've worked on many sustainably designed projects through LEED, B3, and energy design assistance. And I'm also the past chair of AIA Minnesota's Committee on the Environment. Last December, I was fortunate to travel to Katowice, Poland, through a delegation with the climate generation organization, Will Steger Legacy. And we participated in the United Nations climate change negotiations there. Our delegation was made up of business leaders from Minnesota, including a local restaurant, a representative from Best Buy, and a representative from Target. While in Poland, we got to see the global climate negotiations firsthand and experience the urgency needed to help with our ensuing climate crisis. Buildings account for roughly 40% of global CO2 emissions, so architects are uniquely positioned to make a large impact. The increasingly stringent energy goals of SB 2030, a part of B3 that was mentioned earlier today, is a great way to reduce these emissions. It can be a challenge to design buildings that perform this well, but architects and design teams in Minnesota are doing it every day. One example is the Minnesota Senate building, which you are probably all familiar with. My office designed that a few years ago. Not only was it designed to meet the programmatic, security, aesthetic, and longevity requirements for the state, it's also incredibly energy efficient. It was designed to be 73% better than an average building and is now performing 78% better with the addition of the solar panels on the roof. This building will be serving the state and saving on its utility bills for decades to come. To achieve high efficiency results like these, utility-sponsored programs like energy design assistance can be a great tool for design teams and owners to evaluate the costs and benefits of options early in projects, and typically the owner gets a rebate in the end of the project. The Department of Commerce's Conservation Improvement Program is another great example that helps Minnesotans use electricity and natural gas more efficiently. Conserving energy, reducing CO2 emissions, and lessening the need for new utility infrastructure. Our clients are increasingly asking for energy efficiency and climate resilience in our work. Many clients would not have completed projects with any measures beyond code requirements without programs like these. More and better supported programs like these help our clients develop projects that protect Minnesota's environment. Minnesota has been a leader in sustainability and building energy efficiency for many years. AIA Minnesota is here as a resource and looks forward to working with the legislature to continue this valuable effort. Thank you.
Appreciate your coming and the offer. Thank you so much. Members, that's the end of this session. We're going to have success stories on Thursday, and we will be announcing our next meeting this afternoon. So thank you all for coming. With that, the meeting's adjourned.